So please pray with me. This is the prayer of St. Francis before the crucifix. Most high, glorious God.
Most high, glorious God.
Cast your light into the darkness.
Cast your light into the darkness.
Of my heart.
Of my heart.
Of my heart.
Give me, Lord, right faith, firm hope, perfect charity.
Give me, Lord, right faith, firm hope, perfect charity.
And profound humility.
And profound humility.
With wisdom and perception.
With wisdom and perception.
So that I may carry out.
So that I may carry out.
What is your is truly your holy will.
What is truly your holy will.
Amen.
Amen.
And Kate has one from Claire, from St. Clair.
Oh, here is her picture on the little card we got. So I guess we can say this and repeat it again. Our Lord bless thee and keep thee.
Our Lord bless thee and keep thee.
May he show his face to thee.
May he show his face to thee.
And have mercy on thee.
And have mercy on us.
May he turn his countenance to thee.
May he turn his countenance to thee.
And give thee peace.
And give thee peace.
Our Lord be with thee at all times.
Our Lord be with thee at all times.
And grant that thou be in him always.
And grant that thou be in him always.
Thank you.
So all that music was available to on some of the emails we sent out. Devotional wise, it was those were by far the best. We have some other ones that are good in an Orthodox setting, but they have to be worked on a little bit to remove some of the noise and other things going on. As I said in the last one of the last emails, it's a very Catholic world that we found ourselves in. And I think overall, I really, it makes me appreciate the Catholic traditions and what they've, what the church itself is. There's so many problems with it, but it's such a huge organization. And I'm willing to admit that we shouldn't expect perfection. We shouldn't expect everything to work out perfectly. What they have is great. It's a tremendous, tremendous understanding of God and the religious and the spiritual path.
One thing it really let us see, I think, when because we're all kind of removed from organized religion and church, and because where we live is so secular, as is a lot of the West, we were in very Catholic religious places, and you got to see that the religion is still alive, and that there are people who deeply believe it's part of their lives, and very much like we've encountered in India. So it's really wonderful to get that part of our path, which is deeply Christian as well as yogic, and to kind of reconcile ourselves to that part of the path. Certainly Mother had been raised Catholic and had a lot of things to say against the church.
And why she left.
But I think she would be very happy to see people who have a true walk with God. And a lot of these people did.
It's interesting, too, that the churches we all know are empty, except for the American Catholic churches. But even then, they overbuilt, I think, is one way of looking at it. There's so much growth for so many centuries that there's so many churches that are there and unfilled. And so you think, well, the church is dying. In reality, the core group is huge. They come to these pilgrimage spots. And from every European country, whether they go to church there in their own country or not, it's not clear.
Well, I'm sure most of these people do. And we should say not just European. We encountered lots of Christian Indians, Africans,
South Americans,
lots of South Americans. So from all over the world, we saw people in each of these spots.
So the core really is strong. And I think it's also probably true of the Protestant churches. But I think these pilgrimage sites are another beautiful part of the tradition the Catholics bring to the table. It is difficult in some respects to see the materialism, spiritual materialism associated with it. But it's so easy to let go of all of that when you just focus on the spiritual. There's so many devout souls, so many wonderful people we met, and so much talk of God, not politics, history, any of that. It's just talk of their walk with God. So it's very inspiring. Very different in Jerusalem. So we can start there. It's a divided city. Even the church itself, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, probably should be and is the holiest Christian site on the planet. But after seeing, later towards the end of our trip, I saw Rome for the first time and saw St. Peter's Basilica. And my gosh, you realize that's the center of such an amazing, amazing place. And it's clearly the center of a huge history, a long, long history. Fantastic. And everything is an evidence of that. So much given to the church, so much money, so much grandeur. But it was overall really well done. In Jerusalem, it's not so cohesive. There's the Armenians, there's the Greek Orthodox, and I forget there's one other, but of course the Catholics also have a say. The Coptics have a say in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And they don't get along all that well. And they have, whenever there's an event that's coinciding, they just talk over each other. And so it was difficult to see some of that. Overall, though, Jerusalem was absolutely fantastic for me. It exceeded my greatest hopes in many respects. I felt all of the spiritual energy that had been invested in that city, so much is just gone of the negative, and just focus easily on how rich that city is in the spiritual power. But it's a result of man's mixing of different cultures and everything. And so in a way, it's a microcosm of the difficulties that we are having all over the world. And so in that sense, I could put up with a lot. What do you think?
Well, I think that, and it was our first place, and it was someplace I wanted to go for many, many years. And so having gone to Jerusalem and Israel fulfilled something really deep in me. Mm-hmm. The difference of Jerusalem and the other sites we went to, especially the particular pilgrimage sites where you have Lourdes and it's all dedicated to the vision of Mary from St. Bernadette. So it's a very focused place. It's one religion that goes there, basically. And so Jerusalem doesn't have that. And you kind of feel those tensions all the time. We were staying in the Jewish quarter. You feel the tensions when there's maybe Jews and Muslims encountering each other on the streets, slight tensions there. And then, of course, you have the soldiers with their great big guns standing in the corner to make sure nothing happens of those tensions. And then, as Larry said, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, we were expecting a lot more, in the sense that there's whole parts of it that are just closed off because they can't decide who's supposed to renovate it, which sect of the church. Mm-hmm. So it's very disappointing in that respect. And for the first couple of days, we kept going, God, why aren't you showing us what we're trying to find here in Jerusalem? And then when that wonderful archbishop directed us to, we somehow had missed the whole place where Gethsemane is, and that particular room.
Golgotha,
I'm sorry, Golgotha was. And that particular room held so much spiritual power.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite unbelievable.
And there's many subterranean places in that church, too, that were a delight to walk through. So much has been done beautifully. It's just, the reality of what's going on there politically. So it's a mixed blessing. I can see why, we have family friends and people who are Protestants, and they never go, why don't they go to Jerusalem? It always makes me wonder. And you can see, first of all, they just feel out of sorts with all the differences between Protestants and the Orthodox, especially in the Armenian Orthodox, the Coptics. There's quite a stark difference, so I think. And also the iconography, all of that is just so different than their walk with God. But do the Protestants have a place? We really puzzled over that as to where to go. We were doing a lot of this on the fly, so we got to choose to go to different places. And we couldn't think of a Protestant place that drew us. We couldn't, I mean, maybe where Martin Luther was, but, in a way that was really more of a protest kind of a place associated with real strike against, more of a political act, let's put it that way. Although I think the Protestants needed to do it, and they were following God's will on that. It was a necessary comeuppance for the Catholic Church to have that happen.
I think what Larry's referred to is we were at Lourdes, and at one point Larry said, I think we've had enough Catholic. And which is kind of surprising because he was the one raised Catholic and I wasn't. And so he said, well, maybe we should go for, Protestant pilgrimage. And probably there are places to go in sense that some Protestant states, but we hadn't planned it. I didn't know where to go. I hadn't felt drawn to go to Germany, for example. So we just kind of decided, no, that's not kind of part of the pilgrimage. Because we had gotten to Lourdes and that was almost as much as we had thought in our mind where we were thinking of going. But at one point we were thinking of going from Turkey up to Romania and Hungary and up to Poland, and so we kind of reverted to that plan and included Poland at the very end. And it was, and God arranged that we found some very cheap tickets from the small town we were in southern France to fly through Sardinia, which was interesting. I mean, we just saw it out the window, and then up to Poland, and Poland was just a delight. And yeah. And we got to have more exposure to Pope John Paul II, Saint Pope John Paul II, which we still have to write about for all of you. We saw him everywhere, actually, in every Catholic place. Mm-hmm. He was prominent. There were pictures
in
of
Jerusalem
him,
as well, yeah.
Statues of him. Everybody loved him and revered him. And then to go to Poland, which is by itself a marvelous country and wonderful people and very devout people, and the churches were alive. We walked into one church that wasn't necessarily a church of note, and it just hit us as we walked in, just this incredible spiritual feeling. And we sat down and meditated, and it just uplifted us. And it was interesting to walk into a few churches. Well, I walked into one in Sweden, and it had almost zero spiritual feeling. And I realized it because it was being used as a social service place. It wasn't even really a church anymore. And it was very sad to see that and feel that. And it wasn't something that we tried to have a preconception, because certainly that church that we wandered into in Poland, it wasn't noted for anything in particular. And we just went in, and it was undeniable, the spiritual feeling in there. So it's, and whether these are places that are particular to us, you know, who knows? Sometimes something would hit me stronger than Larry, and vice versa. You don't know, but God just seemed to guide us. Sometimes he would take us to a place that hadn't been open. All of a sudden, the doors were open, and we walked in.
That happened a lot. It really did. Do you know, in fact, in Rome, we happened to be near the crypt area, and they wouldn't let us in. And then we walked back, just a little while later, and there was a group kind of clustered over by the door, and we just tagged along with them and went down and got to see the whole crypt area. So it was quite amazing. So many things like that happen. That's what you expect, of course, in a way, with the pilgrimage, or you hope for, that God opens doors. And he certainly did. And things really went, the other measure of it, how smoothly everything went. It really was amazing. Almost nowhere did we go. I can't think of anywhere where we went where we didn't have somebody to help us. Just happenstance sometimes, too. It's like Papa's story, you know, in quest of God.
So, especially for people that didn't plan. I mean, we planned a couple of aspects of our trip, and that was it. We sometimes didn't even know the next step. And God wouldn't let us do it. It was, you know, when we try sometimes, we'd sit down, and it wouldn't happen. We couldn't settle on it. And then all of a sudden, it would just be, the way would be clear, and the tickets would happen, and the accommodation would happen, and it would just all fall in place. Those kind of things still take time. You've got to go on the internet and all that. So we took a lot of time doing that during the trip rather than before. But I don't think we could have planned the trip before. We wouldn't have necessarily known where to go. And in Medjugorje, we thought of going, but it seemed like it might be difficult to get there.
And it turned out to be very easy.
Then it all fell into place, too, and mm-hmm. and was one of the more delightful places to go.
You know, I was asked by a friend here. I just went to lunch with a friend yesterday or day before, I forget. And he said, well, what did you learn? Did you have anything change yet? I really was puzzled with the question. I couldn't answer him at the time. I think I'm going to write to him and answer him more intelligently. But it's like I still am absorbing and processing it. So I think that's really what it comes down to. I just don't have any clear articulation of the whole trip in my mind. It does feel as though we've gone through some grand, experience that is it's a whole. And so I think it is a necessary thing to do. I think it is something, one thing for sure, it hits me very strongly how important it is to do something like this. It's like the Muslims, the Hajj, you're actually required to do it. If you're healthy enough and can afford it, and it's possible, you're supposed to do the Hajj. And so I can only promote it as an idea that it's, you may not want to put commandments down on this, but it certainly is something that should be done in the latter part of life, and earlier if you can do it. Wonderful, wonderful thing.
Even if you just go to one place or...
Oh, absolutely. You can, I mean, there's a lot of people we saw who are staying in one place for a week to 10 days and then going home because that's all they could afford and schedule. And I'm sure they benefited from that. It's tremendous. These places are tremendous.
It's amazing how many times it's kind of like going to the ashram. They said, when are you coming back? And when we were in Medjugorje, everybody was stuck. The person at the hotel, we left something there. She said, well, you can get it when you come back. So and we found out that actually there were a number of people that had been back there numerous times. So it seemed to be kind of their ashram in the sense that that how we feel about the ashram is it's the other home that you go to. And for them, that they found that kind of spiritual home there. I don't think it's interesting because we were always a little bit on the outside. Not being practicing Catholics, we weren't part of the in crowd, and that was okay because we weren't completely just observing because we were participating. Sometimes actually participating by being at the Mass or being at the candlelight procession, but for us it was all, you know, internal and what did God want us to discover there about our own path and about ourselves? So
we felt buoyed up spiritually at so many places. That's the one thing that comes to me just now as Kate's saying this. I felt lifted, uplifted. We always talk about that. But it was a buoying effect. It just lifted your understanding of the world. And it lifted the certainty that this spiritual life is completely sufficient for living even today. It's amazing, amazing, amazing how much we see, how glad we were to see the faith from all of the three faiths we saw, which was, we did see a lot of the Muslim faith in Israel and Egypt and Turkey. Really, we had, I think, wonderful experiences with that. And the Jewish was more complicated. Israel is a complicated city, and we were living in the Jewish, staying in the Jewish quarter, which I guess is probably half Hasidic Jews with the curls and such things. But they were very standoffish. I mean, so we really had the best reactions and best, you know, interactions with the Muslims in the Muslim quarter. And I think I mentioned that in one of the letters, is that often because we had clear knowledge that it was during Passion Week and we were going through Via Dolorosa, which goes right through the Muslim quarter. So that was, but still, it sticks in my mind that probably in Jerusalem itself, we had more positive interactions with individuals there from the Muslims quarter than almost anybody else.
Certainly we met a number of Christians too. And we met a wonderful rabbi in, he and his brother run a store, of religious, items and,
maps. So too.
And we, went in there. They actually grew up in Montreal. So I had an immediate, bond with Montreal, Toronto, with them. But the rabbi, I think the whole family ended up moving to Israel. And, he has a very strong feeling that Israel is meant to lead the world in spirit. And that it was going to come from all the religions and that, and it's going to bring the world back to God. So it's a wonderful thing that he believes that. It's not, you know, it's not clear to us that that's the case, but he's doing his part by every person that comes in, whether they're a Christian. A lot of Christians come in to just, And he talks to them and he tells them about Judaism and tells them about, tries to bring in the commonality between, probably he doesn't get very many Muslim people coming in there, but certainly Christians that are there and shopping for various things. He also didn't do any kind of a hard sell. He didn't do any kind of sell at all.
Yeah, it was just spiritual. Yeah, he had a really wonderful ambience, feeling around him for sure. By the way, if any of you have questions, please read. This is what we intend was to take questions too. So, but anyway, just to complete the Muslim story, in Egypt we were on the tour, so it was a little bit different. But it was interesting to hear the imams, or the call to prayers in all these different places. I really enjoyed that. We have several recordings of some of the, and oftentimes, of course, it's a large speaker. And boy, the other thing that was amazing is how many mosques there are in these countries. When we were going up the Nile, I never could look out on almost bare patches without seeing at least one mosque, and usually I counted them at different times. Three or four were in the distance. You could see mosques everywhere. So it's like seeing, you know, a really Christian part of Europe, where you can see steeples sticking up, you know, four or five in a row. It's very similar in that sense. Turkey also. Turkey is much more secular. We found the Egyptian people to be, there's a lot of touts and a lot of hard sell, but there were also a lot of very devout Muslims in there.
Yeah. Our guide said to us, how many people in the West believe in God? And we said, well, I don't know. I don't remember what our answer was. He said, in Egypt, 95%.
He was fairly devout and very interesting guy.
I'd say the most religious place we went to as far as Muslim religion was in Konya, where Rumi's tomb was, and that was really quite a wonderful experience. Otherwise, there was always a little bit, unless it was more of a touristy place, there was a little hesitation on going into some mosque over there. We were welcome or not, and so we did go into some, but we didn't go into any in Jerusalem, for example.
Yeah.
So there was a little hesitation on our part.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to the Baha'i Gardens, but we didn't get a chance to. The place was closed because of COVID, so we didn't get any chance to see anything about them. We can't forget Assisi, which was really one of the big highlights of the whole trip. Absolutely wonderful from beginning to end.
It's a gem. It truly is. There's so much there. I think you can, and the spiritual feeling from the original master is so strongly there that it's not overlaid with anything else. You know, we love Claire and rather St. Bernard and so many other of the saints who were part of his thing, but St. Francis ruled over it all. You felt him everywhere, just amazing. And it was just such a peaceful, beautiful place. You know, I think you saw some of the pictures, the setting. It's just really wonderful.
And it doesn't even matter that there's tourists who maybe don't have a lot of connection to St. Francis, you know, the little tourist shops as you walk. Just the whole place feels like St. Francis. And it hasn't been sullied by commercialism or anything. It's just something very pure about the whole place.
Petrolcina was like that too. San Giovanni Rotondo is the name of a town. I thought it was the name of the basilica there, but it's not. So that's where Padre Pio was. But where his home, where he lived as a child, is very powerful. Just because it's smaller, I suppose, and just that we had this feeling within our hearts when we were there that was just quite amazing. So I loved especially seeing the big church, which we mentioned before. You probably read, if you read some of this, we didn't understand or appreciate how great the new church was. This is a very modern building. Inside is quite beautiful and quite nice. But then to go downstairs into the crypt, so-called, I mean, it's glorious colors and everything. It's not like most crypts. And so that really was just fantastic in itself. And completely fulfilling. But Petrogina is more like a CC, had more of a feeling of a CC too, just to look at what it was like, where he actually lived, and where what happened to him as a child, and how he changed the world in his part of the world anyway, from coming from such humble, very, very humble beginnings, small town. So Medjugorje, I really, really loved it. It was wonderful. 100%, 99% Catholic there. Lourdes was much more mixed. Lourdes was wonderful too.
How is it mixed? It's like 9% Catholic.
Well, yeah, it's actually mainly 70% Catholic. But,
yeah, it's.
Lourdes is more well known amongst the other people. We did see more secular people, not pilgrims, but just tourists.
Did you go to any of the areas around Assisi for St. Francis sites? Can you talk about this?
All of them. Yeah. I mean, all of them we could get to, and they were wonderful. They were really, really wonderful.
Except for pilgrimage in itself.
Yeah, I had gone to Assisi before, but didn't have a car, so couldn't get out to those outside sites. And they were very special, so many of them.
San Damiano was simply wonderful, beautiful site. And then the Mount the Mount where he used to have a retreat was amazing. The drive there was amazing. Everything was amazing about that. And I think the greatest besides Assisi, though, is Liverna, where he had his stigmata. He wasn't there that long, but it really was a powerful, powerful place. It really had it's a funny mix of secular, because it actually is a national park associated with it for hiking trails and stuff like that. And then they mix there. They don't have separation between church and state, because you saw the lady who took our, you could see there was a full bar and a espresso bar and a cafe.
Well, there's like the mountaineering place that I maybe perhaps part of where the old monastery was. Mm. And then there's the spiritual place, and they do, say if you're coming in here, be silent and all that. So on the other side, there's the mountaineers. So you,
but in the mountaineering point, my point was that there were still brochures for St. Francis and all kinds of, pictures and crosses on the wall and everything. So it's quite delightful.
When we were in Lourdes, they had the, just kind of like at the ashram where they have the day where, or they have, somebody's got a new auto rickshaw, and the swamis will bless, they pour milk on it and they garland it and they bless the auto rickshaw. And, so while we were in Lourdes, it was motorcycle day, and all these bikers came into town, and they were having their biker mass outside.
Yeah, and went to a mass. Bikers went to a mass.
So it's a little different than maybe some of the bikers we've seen before. But that was kind of cute.
Yeah, big, big huge motorcycles, noisy, and all of the things you expect with a biker convention. And then they're coming in to go to mass. Quite delightful. Respectful.
Is Lourdes the name of the town, or is Lourdes the name of the cathedral?
It's a town. It's the name of the town, yeah.
And it's also like a skiing town, and we did take a day to take the funicular up the mountain and saw where, I think that's where the, there's a...
Olympics one?
At least a winter thing there, and they have bicyclists that cycle down the hill and competitive biking and stuff. So we did.
And that looked seriously like hard skiing, but with bikes instead, because these were sheer drops in some of the trails. Just amazing to watch these guys go down these hills at breakneck speeds and then make the switchbacks and everything. Quite interesting.
But it was interesting to see also that there's some days that God would let us do a little side trip, like a tourist trip, like up the mountain on the funicular, and we look all over and see the whole city of Lourdes, and it was a wonderful day, and it felt totally good. And then we went to do something another time, and it was just so unsatisfying. He didn't want us deviating from our intentions. And sometimes it was just, well, we were here in the town and we had kind of finished the other things we wanted to do. And so we'd go to do something. And yeah, most of the time it was okay. But some of the time,
it just wasn't satisfying.
No. We were in this lovely town, the south of France, that we went to after Lourdes because we hadn't figured out where to go. And I said to Larry that I'd been there many, many, 50 years ago on a trip and loved it. And it's, I think I wrote about this, and it's about the Cather area. And we thought, okay. And the town was delightful, and it's almost like you could see yourself living there for the rest of your lives. Nothing negative about it. And we went to look at the old citadel and stuff, but it was... Something was really missing for us. We just, and
I think we felt the heights of what pilgrimage can give you, and that was drawing us to the next place. I really am glad we chose to go to Krakow, where John Paul II was born and raised his first 20 years of his life. And then, well, that put us back in that mode of the spiritual thing. It was very Catholic, but I think I finally had gotten over that. Also, here's an interesting thing we're going to write about. But there's a place called Jasnagora, where the Black Madonna was, the original Black Madonna that's often talked about, if you've heard or seen pictures of, goes back to 1400s.
So it's a huge pilgrimage place, and people come.
What I mean, the picture itself.
Yes. And people have been coming there on pilgrimage for centuries, and we knew about the Black Madonna, but not very much about it, and had no idea that it in itself it is a huge pilgrimage place, and another place where people have healings, and you can see all the rows of crutches and things and rosaries on the wall of all the people who'd had
more
healings.
So than Lourdes. More
and
so than Lourdes.
And Saint John Paul had been, you know, really had a connection there. And then also St. Faustina, we went to her town. She's the one that had drawn the picture of Christ with the kind of rays coming down. And so there ended up being three pilgrimage spots there in Krakow area, which were all worth going to see.
So you forgot one really important thing.
What's that?
You forgot one really important thing.
Uh-oh, tell me.
You forgot to invite me along.
Yeah. Oh, we considered that moderately important.
What was that?
We didn't invite Bob.
Oh. Yes.
We just weren't able to pull it off.
You're forgiven.
Well, that's why we wrote to you. But just as much for ourselves as for you, I have to admit, because it was good for us to get it all down while it was still fresh in our minds, because we've seen so much. That it's easy to get things jumbled about.
So there's just another thought on Jasnagora. So I was reading about why we got interested, and I was reading about John Paul, and I found out about this relationship he had with an archbishop. He's called the Primate of Poland. His name is Wyszynski, Cardinal Wyszynski. He was very important with John Paul II and went through all of the travails of World War II because he was older, and a mentor to him. John Paul loved him dearly. And when we were in Jasnagora, there's a huge site associated with him, not quite as many, say, pictures and stuff, but close to as many pictures of him and statues of him as John Paul II. As well as the Black Madonna and the history, that was part of the basis of the whole place. But in the reading about his relationship with Wyszynski, he mentions Jasnagora as the great place in Poland. He says something to the effect of, I can't remember what he said, but he mentioned Jasnagora completely out of the ordinary, pointing to it directly as such an important place in his own life. And so that's what caused us to want to go there. So Wyszynski is an interesting story because when he became pope, there's two things.
When John Paul became pope.
When John Paul became pope, Wyszynski was really thrilled that he was chosen, because, and he was too old to have been Pope himself anyway, so he wasn't even, and I'm sure didn't want to be, but he was so thrilled that it was a Pole, I'm sure a Polish person, and he loved Karol Wojtyła. And he, when he goes up, there's a famous little snippet of video that shows him going up to visit John Paul just after he was installed as Pope, and he starts to bow down to him, and Pope John Paul stands up and hugged him. And Wyszynski did not want him to. He could see he was trying to stay lower than him. He bowed down. And John Paul reaches down to his hand and kisses the ring, the cardinal ring on his, like he had done as a bishop or certainly a priest. So that's very moving. When John Paul was killed, when he was shot, Wyszynski said that he would give up his life because the Pope's was more important. And he died just a few months later, a few weeks later. So that connection there saved perhaps John Paul's life.
Is your sense that in our terminology, he would have been his guru then?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Good point. Exactly. It fits it to a T. Yeah. And they had gone through World War II and the Soviet occupation at the same time, through all of that they went through together. So, yeah, what they saw.
I think there's a movie about John Paul that where it shows his relationship with that.
That's not something.
But maybe not. But I
think
it's
one with John Voight is quite good, called John Paul II. And then there's the one called The Jewish Cardinal, which is about a friend of his, a man who was Jewish and then converted and became a priest and then a bishop and eventually a cardinal under John Paul II. And that's a fantastic, really well done movie too. Maybe now I need to go back and watch those two. But if you think of the other one, please let me know.
Well, I don't know which one I saw. I think I saw The Jewish Cardinal, and I think I might have seen the other one too, but it's been a while.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. I guess I have to, first of all, I have to thank all of you for your prayers. I know we could feel your prayers with us. And then just mentioned, I mean, Larry already said kind of how well God took care of us. Just really quite unbelievable. We didn't have a single thing happen where we thought, oh, this is terrible, or just kind of despairing or being even annoyed or
all obstacles were removed. We had, Ganesha story associated with it. And I'm sure that's through the prayers of people, so thank you very much.
I mean, we had one time where a flight was late, and we had to go, and we were supposed to be just stopping in Belgrade, and instead we ended up overnight in Belgrade, but they paid for the hotel, and we met a lovely fellow traveler who was delightful, and we didn't care. We weren't on a time limit, so we had the luxury of time. And so when these little things like that happened, we just took it as, we get to see Belgrade we get to fly into Belgrade and see that place. So
we almost always saw some single person. Sometimes it was just to meet somebody.
Uh-huh.
When we look back on it, we realize, wow, that seems to have been just for that person.
We one time couldn't figure out where to eat in a certain place. And we walked up and down, couldn't settle on where to eat. And all of a sudden we went into one little place and ended up talking to the waitress quite a bit, who was just going to be coming over to stay in Canada for a little while. She was Italian and looked like she maybe originally came from Africa, a slight accent. And we talked to her for quite a while. And as we left, Larry said, well, it seemed like an odd place to go for dinner, but I guess we were meant to meet her.
Yeah, it was a weird drive and it ended up there.
And so it was, you just have to trust in that, that God's taking you where he wants you to go. And every now and then when something was shut, we come to a church and wanted a place we wanted to go, and the we couldn't get in. We just always had to see, you know, we just always knew that there was something else we were supposed to do now. Like the time we mentioned in the email when we didn't get a chance to see Padre Pio another time. It was a little hard to understand for a few minutes. And
but Pietrelcina was calling. We really only had that one day. So in a way, it was good that we didn't, that we got on the road right away. So.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, it when you realize, you know, when you don't have so much of an agenda, and I was prone to sometimes having a bit of an agenda, but when you don't have an agenda, you can accept all those things. And you can also accept when we went a couple of places and people say, well, did you see the such and such? No. And did you see the such and such? No, because we didn't even know they existed. So we had to just realize that God would take us to the places or direct us to whatever it was we were supposed to see. And if we missed something, that was okay. You know, we didn't have a bucket list to cross off our list.
But we were following, and I think that it's just what we were following. We were following this desire to have this experience at these sites where your heart is uplifted. It's literally, you know that you've done, you're at the right place when you, the next person place you go pulls you, and then you get there and you feel like this is why you came. Sometimes it's a single place, a single thing, but it's almost, that was a common feeling throughout the all of the spiritual sites. There's something great, truly great about doing this kind of pilgrimage.
The other thing that's interesting is, like, Egypt, I was initially not interested in, when Larry used to say, well, if we go to Israel, we have to go to Egypt. And so it was really not on my list necessarily. And then I decided, well, he really wants to go, that's fine, I'll go. And I can't say that it didn't have the spiritual impact that the rest of the places did for me. I enjoyed seeing so that was more of a tourist place for me. But seeing the culture and the amazement of the various pyramids and stuff. I was hoping we'd have more time with Coptic Egypt, but we didn't have as much time as I would have liked.
Mount Sinai, we didn't go to.
Yeah, we didn't go to a city of those. But at the same time, I started realizing partway into the trip that some of it had to do with a soul's need to revisit a place that you had been at in a past lifetime, and that it was absolutely essential to have been at that place. And so, whether that was true for me or for Larry in one place, it was something also that God was working through with us, of taking us to some places in order for us to purge whatever it was that needed to be purged, or
reconnect
or tweak or whatever. But there was a definite feeling of destiny in some places that that you had to be there, and it really released something. Mm-hmm. So, while it wasn't uplifting in the same way, it was a necessary place to be at.
Seems like there was. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to ask Kate. Was Egypt one of those places that you felt drawn to for some reason, or?
I can't really say it was for me. But flying. Interestingly enough, flying out of Israel via Cyprus, I'd say that whole, and then over to Turkey, there was an awful lot in there that really felt that it had to do with what I was just talking about. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't pinpoint, well, some places I could pinpoint, but so maybe Egypt was a bit of that, but I probably more, since Larry was the one who really wanted to go there, it may have had a more of an importance for him. Mm-hmm. But,
you know, it's interesting. I just read recently that Egypt, I think in Roman times, I think that's where I read it, was the most religious place in the world. It was claimed to be the most religious place in the world. The priests and the whole world, the whole country was in concert, working together on religious grounds for everything. So everybody was religious in those days, I suppose, in some respects. But it was interesting to have that insight into what was what Egypt was all about. And so much of the Christian and Jewish world were affected by Egypt.
We also wanted to go, after having worked on Mother's Book, we wanted to go to some of the places that she referred to in terms of symbology. And so I think that that's why we went to Patmos,
Egypt and Jerusalem.
So there kind of is a background there that maybe, and I think a lot of this, we won't really have the complete sense of for some time, you know, that it's got to, we've got to have it ruminate a little bit and then see. Certainly we have all sorts of pictures that we can use in the future for Crops and Lotus things, and that's
too many to go through. Yeah.
That's a real boon that we won't have to be scrounging the internet anymore, and if we republish Mother's Book, we've got some very apropos pictures to put in. And I've heard that if you take a picture yourself, you legally can use it. So if I take a picture of a picture of St. Francis at Assisi, I'm allowed to use that picture.
Even though maybe a piece of art is copyrighted or not, but the point is that once you take your own picture of it, statues, everything, it's you own it.
Or at least you're able to use it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So.
Did you get a, you know, the religion of the pyramids and the ancient Egyptians? Was there much of that religion or that feeling in the air in Egypt?
It's so completely underground, and there's so many mysteries associated with it. I think there's a great deal of lack of understanding of what they were doing, and I'm puzzled by the whole thing. I've got a couple things I'm working on with Mother's teachings associated with the fact that, you know, whether Jesus really lived the way that's described in the Bible, what the Bible is. And so I'm curious to see, if there's more fruit to be born from that. There's a book called, I just sent a book of this to Rebecca Harvey, that's called The Jesus Mysteries, and it's really, really good. Mother would absolutely love this book. So, and it talks extensively about the myths associated all over the Mediterranean, and all of them copying something that was going on in the Osiris and Horus and Isis cult. And the iconography is so similar to what they do too. I mean, people, the cross, Jesus, I mean, Mary holding a child, all of these things, the Divine Mother. This book is quite amazing. He's really convinced me. He's got what happened with Jesus' story, as Mother saw, was that it's an allegorical story clothed in Christian and Jewish, motifs. And that was basically taking an ancient story of the sacrifice of the God type, God of sacrifice of the God man. So anyway, there's a lot there. I'm very intrigued by it. And I have been for years, but that's why I wanted to go to Egypt, besides my interest in the monuments, all the, the stonework, all of the amazing, especially the pyramids, of course. But there's so much more there. The museums convinced me, my gosh, it's the greatest place in the world for history to puzzle through, because there's so much there that's misunderstood, lack of understanding. Mm-hmm. And I think it's tied in with our teachings.
We saw some really interesting Divine Mother aspects in the Egyptian iconography. Yeah. That was interesting. Yeah.
They go way back. Yeah.
Is it Zoroastrian or something separate from that?
Yeah, the Zoroastrian influenced the Sufis and the what's so-called Gnostics, a lot of the churches of the early time, but nothing reached down there. That's a good question. I don't know how to connect that. There's a lot of terms like the Magus and the Magi and all that that have Egyptian roots, and there seems to be a connection there, but it's pretty much a pretty bad trail right now. There's not a clear trail to connect the dots there. They tended to get displaced into Persia and then moved into India and became Sufis in the Egyptian, in the Islamic world. So, but that Manichaeism and the Zoroastrianism was definitely part of the early Christian. And I had to think about the connection, the other question you just asked. Does it connect with the story, the higher teachings that Mother is? That's a good question, don't know.
Larry, what caught my attention a few years ago was that Egypt was a colony of ancient Greece. The Ptolemies were actually Greek.
That's right, 300 years or so. Yeah.
Of course, the ancient Egypt was there way before the Greeks came.
Yes, yes, but then the Greeks colonized that, Athens, out of Athens.
That's right.
And this was to make money. What else? And they were so successful there that the wealth that Egypt generated was actually greater than what was being generated in Athens. But then that carried over to Constantinople, which was also Greek, and they still controlled during Crusader times. They were still controlling that part of the world. You were the final authority on most of those things, which then got them into conflict at times with the Catholic Crusaders.
Exactly. And then the Islamic, when the Ottomans took over that area, it called changed it to Istanbul, and then they still controlled all of the Muslim worlds of the Middle East anyway.
Yep.
And Cairo was under their control until they had different times they broke away and there was dispute. The two big Islamic centers politically were Istanbul and Cairo. And that's where the madrasas, the teaching, the philosophies all came from. Mecca and Medina were more holy sites like Jerusalem.
We certainly had a sense of history the whole time we were there, that there's just so much history and so much, the center of the...
And so much has been saved. We really were impressed with all of the countries, how well they're preserving things and really making an effort to humidify, rooms, whole rooms, humidified and temperature controlled. So there, and that's something that they're holding for the world, and it brings them lots of money and interest, and that's fine because it's all going to preserve some of these teachings and these artifacts.
How was Patmos?
Oh, I love Patmos. Love Patmos. It was interesting because I was speaking with Jill and telling her that about this. I mentioned in one of the emails about this monastery that was no longer being used, and I could it was a wonderful place. You just got there and you just thought, oh, I could stay here all my life. It's so beautiful. It's so peaceful. And I said, we could just have it for one of our retreats. And Jill said, yes, but what doesn't Mother call Patmos the in-between state? Do we want to all stay in the in-between state? No, that's true. But Patmos itself, in between state or not, that's what Mother has it represent, is a delightful, delightful island. And all these lovely little churches everywhere, more churches apparently per capita than anywhere in the world, some of them not being used, some of them tiny, tiny. But met nice people, wonderful people.
The spiritual feeling there for me, I think you can answer it yourself, but I loved it. I felt good there, and I felt like I could live there. I mean, it really was. It was a delightful place, but it was not. Didn't have the same spiritual feeling that some of the other sites did. But.
And I have to agree with him there.
Not the final.
It's not the final.
That's
well, the St. John's place was certainly a powerful place.
That's the main monastery and site on the whole island.
And especially his cave, I'd say. And
say, Larry and Kate, what is, in your estimation, and you might both have different answers, what place did you go to that had the most spiritual feeling?
That's difficult.
I think Assisi. And then... I'm torn. I think it was where St. Francis is buried in the crypt there, underneath his basilica. And then I did love Laverna also, which was, that's actually 90 miles, or I think it's 70 miles away. and long drive way up a mountain. It was really not difficult, but it was a lot further than you'd think. How in the world did he get there? So those two places probably have to be at the center. I'm sorry to say that I don't include Jerusalem with that, because it was such a mixed feeling there. Overall, very good and truly wonderful insights. And I was sitting on the Mount of Olives, looking out over the Eastern Wall. It was so, so powerful. So that comes to mind also.
And it's the one that's farthest away from us now in terms of time.
Yeah, good point. But I did love the Mary sites, Medjugorje, Lourdes. Really, really wonderful.
Although I think we found also, too, that it was nice to be at a site where there was an actual, where a saint, you know, where there was a saint. The focus was on a saint,
and
so Saint Francis. And we really actually got to know Bernadette, Saint Bernadette, who had seen Mary at Lourdes. So I think that we really found those saint places the most accessible to spiritual feeling, and you know Padre Pio's. I can't name one. I think they're all, but when we were at Assisi, we went, this is marvelous. This made our pilgrimage, you know, the pilgrimage. We've become real pilgrims having been here. You know, another person might go and say, well, it's a little more commercial than I wanted, or it's, you know, but it really was wonderful for us.
Thank you.
Yes, and walking up on the, as Larry says, the Mount of Olives was wonderful. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I have to say, was amazing. We didn't go to Bethlehem, so we can't say about that.
We went to Capernaum and Nazareth, which we both loved a lot. That was also very nice. So there's a lot in Israel that's very much palpably, spiritually, and powerful. But I guess I think I would have to agree that the places that the saints lived seem to be more power in those sites, you know, so for me.
I enjoyed all of your accounts of the saints. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with David after my tour of churches prior to Mother coming into my life. My conclusion was that the reason the Catholic Church, and for that matter, the Anglican Church, have survived to the extent that they have as a active and vital factor in life is because they revere their saints. Mm-hmm. Protestants don't really do that.
Absolutely.
In fact, the Protestants threw all saints off the bus, didn't they? To a great extent.
That's true.
Because
their notion is that the last saint was the last disciple of Christ, and beyond that,
there's well, yeah, good point.
Pretty much, yeah.
And I really do. I've noticed that even here in Victoria, where you know, the Anglicans, for example, are quite besotted with their saints, their Catholic saints, mind you, but they accept the Catholic saints.
Yeah, of course they do, because they all precede. Many of them precede the schism between them.
Yeah.
I even have a new saint that kept introducing himself to me. So many places we went, all of a sudden his picture would pop up and he would demand that I looked at him. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about him. And his name is Saint, I'll see if I can find a picture of him, because I'm going to look into him now. He's from Lebanon. And unfortunately, we didn't know about him in Israel, or we might have tried to go over to Lebanon.
This is his Catholic feast day, too, today.
Yes, I sent something to Lorraine.
I think it might be in the kitchen, Kate.
Okay.
And when you see the picture, I had seen the picture before, years ago. But yeah, she was right. Look, what do we see the most? If we do all these Catholic places, John Paul II, Padre Pio, and St. Francis.
St. Charbel.
And then this man here.
Yeah.
Charbel?
Charbel.
Yeah, move it up.
His body was...
Move it closer.
Like Masters, his body did not decay at all. In fact, it did all sorts of amazing miracles about him. But I might write about him for the Catholic
news that came up that popped up when I Googled him just now said the Lebanese saint who unites Christians and Muslims.
Yeah, there's all sorts of Muslims.
Which, that feels like part of what your pilgrimage was about too, was that kind of appreciation for the Muslim community.
Right. It's interesting because it is, there were difficulties around that too, because I can't tell you, we met a number of people whose lives had been totally disrupted by the tensions and the Muslims coming into their area and not allowing them to worship and killing them and everything else. But
your experience with the Muslim people that you interacted with seemed like it was all very positive.
It was all good.
Also, the measure of how strong is the spiritual strength of the Muslims is very strong. I mean, their belief in God and their belief in doing, you know, being part of the religious tradition, all of that's very strong.
Having it in their everyday life. Mm-hmm. And certainly we did not meet anybody who was, fanatical or had, had any animosity towards anybody else. Rumi, of course, when you're in Konya, Rumi is such a uniter of everything and so many people love him that you wouldn't expect people going to worship at Rumi's shrine to be intolerant.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I guess we should close off. I come back. I could have kept on going. I was quite a happy pilgrim most of the time. It really quite suited me. Like Larry said, schlepping bags and doing some of that got kind of old. But it was really, we just kept looking at each other and saying, aren't we blessed? Aren't we fortunate to be doing this? What an amazing, amazing privilege to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny, too, because we'll probably never, if things proceed back to normalcy, this ability to see these places with so few people was remarkable. Until we got to Rome, it was virtually never a problem being overpopulated or overrun.
Yeah, the door opened, we came in, and then the door started shutting again. We were just hearing of new restrictions here and there, and so the timing was perfect.
And the weather was perfect so much, and the flowers everywhere. Sisi was just amazing, just from a natural point of view.
World is God. Mm-hmm. Really was wonderful.
Well,
come with us.
Well, you got, it's maybe a silly question. Will you be making kind of like a slideshow type of thing for that you'll be sharing with us?
Yeah, sure will. And we have quite a bit more music than the three we just did this morning. The three we did this morning, I just didn't have to do anything. They were already cut correctly or at least good enough. Whereas we have some amazing Orthodox singing, but it's got so much other disturbances and people walking through and making noise and all that. And so I'm going to cut that up and make some audio out of that. And then we'll have audio with some video and pictures. I'll probably put together a 20-minute slideshow or more, 20 to 30-minute slideshow.
How about
a little booklet, a little battle journal?
We might. We'll see. We certainly have more to write about it if we take our time to do it. I'd have to say language was a kind of a. I didn't so much see it as a problem, but you have to realize that we were partially shut out of something just because of the language thing, and because we didn't have guides except for in Egypt. So we'd see these big, tour buses coming, and they'd all get out, in Medjugorje, and they all did the things together, and they had sometimes even their own priests taking them through masses, and they'd all do stuff together, and we were always kind of on the outside of that. We would check in from time to time. It always felt like that's what we were supposed to be doing. But we wouldn't always get the whole picture. And
Because they had guides, you know, professional guides, a lot of them. And we'd pick up some of the conversation and get some clues, but mostly we didn't try to, you know, hang around with them, English-speaking guides too much, because I don't think they liked it, you know. So
hold in on their guides. But we're lucky we speak English and not another language, because often if there were two or three languages, you know, with little placards, it was English. And so we were very fortunate in that way that we got to do more than a lot of people. It's actually still amazing how many people don't speak English. I guess it isn't that amazing, but we did encounter.
You mean when you're in non-English speaking countries?
I know, imagine that. Why don't you speak English?
Yeah, some places really emphasize it in the schooling, even young. Certainly all the Scandinavian and probably Germany less so, but most of these countries have English as part of their growing up. So.
But we managed. That's why we ended up hanging out with Indians a lot. It's interesting. We go to Europe, we hang out with Indians. But because, first of all, they spoke English. Secondly, we kind of have an affinity with the culture. We're both, we're not people who live in that culture. And they're almost all Christians, Indian Christians. But Indian Christians love to do pilgrimage too. Like, just like there's so many people that do pilgrimage in India, Indian Christians go to Christian sites like Lourdes, lots of them in Lourdes, and we met a number of people that we had really a good time with, and we had dinner with maybe and stuff. We would mention, they'd say, why have you been in India so much? We'd mention the ashram, and they wouldn't necessarily completely get that, but they kind of understood maybe a bit better than somebody who wasn't Indian.
There was one Bangladeshi family who was Muslim, and he was in the military. Very interesting guy. Really enjoyed him.
That was at Ephesus or Cappadocia. That was in Turkey. Lots of Indians in Turkey too. Mm-hmm. Maybe more Muslim Indians. I don't know, but they like Turkey. So that was one group we kind of tended to see.
It's interesting as I think about the culture, the world culture includes and by the way, most of the Indians, I think a lot of the Indians that we met were from the South. So that, we had that in common too. But yeah, culturally, from an educated point of view, not the peasant level or, you know, the uneducated, I'm sure, but that's still, it felt like the same culture. So interesting. I mean, look at the people we met from Chile and all over. And who spoke English? I mean, my gosh, we had such a commonality because we were usually around Christian sites. We had that in common in the language and the understanding and the enjoyment of just having conversations with people and having dinner with them and all that. That was so easy to take part in.
But at the same time, I think the disappointment would have been, if we had any disappointments of our trip, that we were really hoping we'd meet somebody that just was ready for Mother's and David's path. And that would be saying, oh, now this is the kind of teachings I wanted all my life. We didn't, that didn't
happen. The only book we gave away of Mother's Mystical Crucifixion was to the Ananda group.
But we have no idea how they received it. Yeah. So we... But that would be, I think, the only thing that I would say, and it might be, it's probably language partly. It's because we're meeting people who are very firm in their own Christian faith. They're not people who are seeking something else, and just maybe the length of time we spent. But you'd also think that maybe God would have us cross paths with just that person, but it was not to be.
No.
Not to be. So it... I mean, we certainly know what we received from this trip. I don't know whether anyone else received anything from us having been there. So, anyways, just the way it is.
You guys have done more than your share of giving. It's okay to just receive for this.
We did lots of praying, I have to tell you. Every single altar, we were lighting candles and praying for everybody and praying for the world. We did lots of that. Hours and hours and hours of that, of praying for the people in our group who need the prayers and the...
So many of these sites were easy to do that. You could just sit down in a pew and just go within so easily. So that's the measure of a place for sure.
And it really felt drawn to go up and light the candles and pray to the, you know, whatever saint or deity that was there. I was compelled to do it every time. And it wasn't a difficult compulsion. It was everything in me took me up there to pray. So we did do that.
Somewhere between 50 and 100 candles, I would imagine.
When we were in, we'll end soon because I know you all have other things to do, in Lourdes, and we met that one, an Indian family from Mumbai, Christians, and they were there at Lourdes. They've been taking their kids on a kind of a European tour. They had teenage kids. Wonderful family. And I think we met them maybe the second day we were there. He said, "Have you gone to the candlelight procession?" And we said, "Oh, we have." And it was kind of raining. We just have it. You know, we didn't do everything that all the Catholics did. "You have to go. You have to go. How could you not? We went last night. We're going again tonight. Doesn't matter if it's rainy. It's wonderful." So we did. We went that night. We felt like God gave us our marching orders. And
we thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah.
And, you know, there was something really wonderful about walking that procession. At something really wonderful about having that candle. It was really moving to be part of that. Yeah. That whole group that was singing the Ave Maria, which I now learned, not being Catholic, I never learned it. And it was very much a feeling of part of this wonderful.
Well, you know, everywhere we went, though, it was a spiritual site. So everybody was so sweet and in a good space that it was always like that. Especially, I have to say, it's the Catholic sites where you could just enjoy being with people and smiling and always getting out of the way, helping people move or anything like that. It was just so easy.
Saw any conflict.
Yeah, no negative.
No conflict.
No one frowning at you. It was all smiles everywhere, too. It truly was.
Everybody's on their best behavior.
Yeah. God is watching. When you're in these churches, boy, I'm telling you.
Yeah. I mean, every now and then you'd find that when I made my little joke about the Italians at that one place that the Polish guy said, there are some noisy people who don't seem to know what silence is. Right. But other than that, I mean, and you could hardly be angry at them because they had these lovely, sweet smiles. They just didn't have the same sense of what we wanted to do in the space, which was sit and meditate. But everybody was in good behavior. And you could just feel that, wouldn't it be nice that the world was like this all the time, you know? That the world could just get along like this. And shopkeepers were nice. You know, yeah, pretty good. All sorts of races mixing. We can't wait to see you all, hopefully before too long. It's been too long.
We're thinking
Larry G. Larry G., will you give us a couple of refrains of Ave Maria, being that you're trained?
You know, I don't know that I could.
Yeah, you can.
The actual words or singing it?
Well, just the Ave, just Ave Maria. Oh, they, if I could sing, I would, but I can't. Nobody wants that.
Kate, go ahead.
Larry's the train.
Can do it. Boy. Can you do it? No. Terry can do it.
Larry.
Yeah, I always get confused in the pool, but the pool is very easy.
You know it, Larry. No? Kate?
Yeah. No.
No? It's not coming?
No. Well, I mean, I don't know it well enough. It's funny, those patches of Latin that I remember, certain prayers and stuff, but...
In Medjugorje, they get together in this great big outdoor place. Huge. I mean, it can fit thousands. And they all do the rosary over and over again for an hour. They meditate, and then they'll start in again. On through the whole rosary, and just amazing devotion.
And, oh, here's one more thing to mention is how many confessional booths there were. I think that one of these places for Catholics, this is just the experience of Catholics. You want to take communion, you want to take part in the whole thing, and confession is part of that. And I had kind of forgotten how important it was to the Orthodox, the more conservative approach to Catholicism, that, yeah, you go to confession before you have communion.
Yeah. Prior to Vatican II, you had to go, right? And then there was the general absolution that came after Vatican II.
Right. Well, and this is harkening back to the previous one.
Yeah.
No, I grew up in the middle of Vatican II, so confession was still part of it. The general absolution all happened after I was not associated. That was in the 70s, whereas in the 60s, it was still, confessions were considered part of it. And only, I remember in the seminary, the notion of general absolution was discussed, but none of the priests thought highly of it. So I remember that distinctly, that you could do it that way. It just seemed cheating. Or perhaps, but they didn't think it was proper. Now, there was none of the priests that I was associated with didn't like, you know, none of them resisted the Vatican II changes, but you know, except for something like trivial, what was considered lower level. Most of the things, turning the altar around, all of those things, and speaking in the vernacular, which were trip points for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That was never in question.
I should say, I mean, I don't mean to end on a negative note, but here is something that we have that Mother gave us, is that freedom from the same kind of thought of sin and having to, how, you know, the heaven and hell. We were on Patmos, this beautiful, beautiful little nunnery, and we met this German woman. She was a nun, showed us all around. I may have written about this, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to end this lovely discussion with her about basically her telling about how everybody's going to hell unless they take Jesus as their savior.
You have this chance now.
You have this chance, yeah. Everybody gives that chance. We tell them about it, and if you miss it, well, too bad. Down you go. And so,
not quite that bad, but that was implicitly what,
and it's too bad because we were all uplifted in the idea of this beautiful church and this and this picture that had changed because of this miracle that had happened, and so we were uplifted in God, and then for her to kind of bring us down to that level. And anyways, it made us feel very happy for our own path.
Yeah, well, and that's related to the confession, wasn't it? Because the notion of the confession is that, I mean, one thing is it's just a sacrament you have to take part in, but it's also that you need to be free of mortal sins in order to take communion. You can't go, you have to be in a state of grace to take communion. No.
I have to say to all you people that were raised Catholic, I wasn't raised Catholic, so I'm free of all the rules. There were a couple times that I was at a mass and I felt like taking communion and I went up and took it. And I know that it that maybe those raised Catholic would go, oof, you're not supposed to do that. But I had none of those strictures. I was free. And Larry said, well, Mother says, you're taking it inside. You don't have to take it on outside. And I said, yeah, but I wanted to take it on the outside at that point. I was moved to take it on the outside. Mm-hmm. And I took it and I... And it felt right, and I didn't care that I wasn't in that following the rules, because I never signed off to the rules. So, you know, I'm free of the rules. I'm outside. So,
the commandment comes from Jesus, so you can follow that, and also you were baptized and confirmed. So those all play into it, but yeah, it's a confusing situation what to do. We don't want to be disrespectful.
No, I never wanted to be disrespectful, and I started finding myself, you walk into the church and everybody's doing this, and I it's certainly not part of my background. I found myself wanting to do it. I found myself wanting to bow to the altar. It just was part of that feeling of I wanted to be respectful. And same with, you know, I go into the mosque and I immediately did that. And it's just, I don't want them thinking that I don't respect their religion. You know? And we learned that in India. You know, we learned that that you need to have that respect for the people that are there being religious.
Well, and then you join in. I mean, it's not just respect for what they're doing. It's finding God through that in that moment, right?
Well, and see, it comes down to taking part in this gestalt. It's psychic feeling in the whole room. And you willingly take part in that to the extent you can. And you certainly don't present a resistance or a negative kind of censorious or a critical mind to this. You don't introduce that into that environment. You just don't. It's not proper. You want to take part in it, and you can to the extent you can, but certainly there's so much rich feeling in the room. It's such a powerful feeling that when you join it, it is you add to it and you take part in it. It's a way of, it's a communion of its own.
Like, and it's interesting how God would sometimes let us, I mean, wanted us to take part. And then other times we
were more outsiders.
We held ourselves. It didn't feel right. It felt like we would have been phonies. It felt like it just interesting. Every time was a particular to itself, and we just had to follow with what we felt at the moment. So,
you were saying, Jerry?
I was just saying I like what you said there. I think it would be a disturbance on a plane that maybe we don't necessarily always recognize, but I think it would be a disturbance if you went in there with disrespect or with negative thoughts. So I like that, to go with a positive approach.
Well, as Kate said, when we as Westerners go to India, we take part by watching them and everything, and we gladly do what they do. Why would we not do it to our own religious background, whether we accept our particular denominations or not? Why wouldn't we at least be as respectful to them as we are to the Hindus? I mean, Hindu temples are quite strange to Catholics and to Christians. Yeah.
And who among us doesn't love Jesus? I mean.
So true, exactly. And how many people who are of every other background say something similar about Jesus. He is held up as a, and it's funny too to think of St. Francis in the same way. He seems to be a universal saint. Even Protestants like to learn about him and like the stories about him.
And Swamiji, Swami Muktananda, wrote to us after we were at Assisi and was saying, oh, how wonderful to be at St. Francis's place. Mm-hmm. And so everybody responds to him. And his statue is in many churches all around, all these countries we're at. His statue is there.
So let's say the closing prayer. We'll say it together so you get me through the hard part. Oh,
Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am in thee. Lovely to see your faces again.
Likewise.
I can feel Mother and David here in the room with us.
We often felt David with us. You know, we often did. Just that we'd say, wouldn't David like this? So he was enjoying it through us, but we would feel, oh, this would be a place he would like, or this would be a thing he would like. Yeah. Anyways.
Welcome okay. home.
Thank you. Mario. See you again soon, yeah. We hope. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for being there. Thank you so much. Yeah.